received the booklet and read it and studied it, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, what it will be like, would you raise your hand? Still pretty well over half the people. I would certainly encourage anyone who hasn't to request it and just request the book on The Wonderful World Tomorrow, because it gives a very good overall framework of the coming government of God within the overall plan of God from beginning to the end and out into the world tomorrow and down into eternity, that makes the plan and purpose that God is working out here below have a definite logic, practicality, and purpose, unlike Satan has palmed off on the world by way of a false God and a false Christ and false Christianity, a syrupy, senseless, worthless, purposeless plan where God's just concerned about getting souls, you know, but he doesn't have any overall purpose what they do up there. Some go so far as to say we might pluck harps and wax wings, but that's about as far as it goes, and that couldn't turn on too many people, you know, because as far as harp music is concerned, I wouldn't be all that enthusiastic about hearing it forever, and I'm sure no one else would want to hear me forever, and I would get rather tired of either waxing wings or having mine waxed, if that's what we get for our souls. But this makes it very meaningful and practical once you understand you know, some of the basis for what God is doing on the earth. It shows the government that Christ is going to establish on this earth at his second coming is going to be a highly organized government. It's going to be a government in which personnel serve that were trained at the period of time in the history of mankind on this earth when the training conditions were just right to train an expert in a particular field of service. And God chose to call one, and of course he made sure the person is on the scene. I mean, that's no problem with God. He's the author of procreation. He knows DNA, genes, and chromosomes perfectly. He knows how to intervene in family lines and get just what he wants. I mean, he doesn't miss it one billionth of a degree. So he made sure that he had the right person on the scene at the time when the conditions in his overall plan were just right to train an expert in a particular field of service. While the world was going the wrong way at that particular time, then he deposits these individuals underground. You see, that's another advantage he has. Trains one, puts them underground, trains another one. It's really not an underground movement. They don't move down there. It's just an underground program. And then he trains another and puts him underground, trains another and puts him underground, maybe trains two or three and puts them underground and right on down. Then he'll resurrect all of them at the same time. And when they come up, they will form a government that has all the qualifications to change the course of life, conduct, and activity on this earth from the way the world's been going to God's way. And these individuals are going to be so well, so converted, and so cooperative, and so responsive that they'll fit within the area of service for which they've been trained. There'll be no overlapping, no one will be prying into others' business, no one will be trying to assume a prerogative or a responsibility that's not his. They'll all fit perfectly. This government's going to have such a balanced framework that everyone knows who's responsible in every major area of service and who works under them, and they will respect guidelines or borders or divisions between the departments, and they will serve in perfect cooperation under the overall supervision of Christ, who will be the head of that team. Then they'll have Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob under him, and they'll be an executive team. And of that team, Abraham will be the chairman, so that he makes the final decision always. They won't get up each morning and vote. Now, who has the right to make the final decision then? Isaac says, well, I don't know. Did I make the ones yesterday? And Abraham says, I don't know. What about you, Jacob? Can you tell? He says, well, let's draw straws again. Won't be any nonsense like that. Abraham will always, without any exceptions, have the final decision in the executive team. And they will be there to supervise both church and state. You know, the average person in religion, church and state, what would God want that for in salvation? He'd want people maybe to operate the modernization machines and the pasteurization and the sanctification and the revivification machines, you know, because it seems like everyone's concerned about all a lot of this spiritual jargon, you know, spiritual terminology, that they've been sanctified and revivified and homogenized and pasteurized, and they're headed to heaven. you know, like, it doesn't really make any sense. It's just a lot of a play on spiritual words, and if they're spiritual, they got to talk like, you know, so everyone knows they're spiritual. So they've got to affect their voice, and they've got to kind of purr and say, thee and thou and thine, we're thine, and all of mine are here, and we're worshiping thou, God, you know, all that affected nonsense. Like God spoke to King James English, you know. Like a woman wrote into Mr. Armstrong one time, and she says, if King James Bible was good enough for Christ, it's good enough for me. That shows about how much people know about languages and how long they've been around and translations of the Bible and what the original Bible is inspired in, Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek, and on and on. So God's government's going to have church and state in it for a purpose. And the State Department will handle all activities that have to do with the nations, grouping all nations together so they're finally all under one government and putting those nations together according to God's master plan, with the 12 tribes of Israel, the leading departments or nations making up this overall grouping of nations or departments. God is going to build a family into a great kingdom or a great corporation, and he'll be the corporate head. And he wants to make sure the family is so ordered by departmentalization, that he as the head of the family can direct and down through a system of control all the members of that family carrying out their particular departmental responsibilities will work together, and it will be a complete corporation. It will have all the balance. It will not have superfluous departments, nor will it lack one. You know, God is determined before he ever started, he knew exactly how many races and nations would be on the face of the earth. Do you know that? And he won't come out with one too many or one too short. He won't have to say to his family, well, it almost worked. I tried hard. I was sincere. But it just won't work. We don't have a department that is necessary to make up the overall whole balance of the family. Or will he have one surface? I didn't know so many of you were going to be around. I just don't have a place for you. You're completely outside of the framework of this corporation. There's nothing for you to do. So what we're going to do, we're going to assign you out here as unemployed, not temporarily, but permanently. There just is no place for you for the rest of eternity, but rejoice, realize I was sincere, and I didn't realize, you know, that I was going to, you know, bring you on the scene and not have a place for you. But you can always remember that I tried, and you do that for eternity, and rejoice that I tried, that you don't have anything to do, and you don't have a part in the family activities. But you can rejoice, you can do, and kind of be on the sidelines, like looking through a glass, an athletic event. All the others are participants. You're out here saying, boy, almost made it, almost qualified for the team. Now I get to watch all this action for all eternity, as long as my neck holds out, you know. So the State Department will have to do with, well, under Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's supervision, who will be supervised by Christ, who will be carrying out his Father's will, and getting a tremendous counsel from his Father. He will not be doing it independently. He will be sending a whole stream of angels back and forth. They'll be coming from his Father in heaven, the third heaven, and they will be bringing messages. The Father will be going back. That's the way to communicate, so he doesn't have to take time out and dial, you know, and find a busy number. Just have a stream of angels coming and going. Have you ever read that in the Bible? Jacob had this dream, you know, saw this ladder reach him to heaven, angels ascending and descending. Then when Nathanael, you know, came to Christ, and Christ says, well, there is an Israelite indeed in whom there is no guile. And Nathanael said, oh, the Son of God. And he said, you haven't seen anything yet. You know, Christ said, Nathanael, I saw you over here under the tree before you ever saw me. In other words, that proved to Nathanael this fellow had supernatural perception. Because he was probably whispering things way over there under the bushes, and he didn't realize anyone was around. Christ said, I saw you over there under the tree before you ever came over here. And Nathanael says, boy, indeed, that's miraculous. He said, you haven't seen anything yet. You wait until you see the Son of Man here on the earth and the angels ascending and descending from him. That's when you'll really see some action. So when he's here in Jerusalem supervising through his government the rebuilding of the world, the building of tomorrow's society, there will be a steady stream of angelic messengers that are bringing messages from his Father and taking them back. Now, I mean, not just one after the other. I mean, every time there's a need to communicate, Christ isn't going to sit down here and yell up in heaven, you know, several billion miles, maybe trillions, maybe centillions of miles. And the father said, yeah! And the whole universe just kind of reverberates, you know. They'll do it through in a very organized manner. God is not the author of confusion, but of peace and order. And everything God does will be done in peace and order once he gets us in order. Now, that's the big job. And why, if there's any disorder in God's church or work, it's because of human beings. We're just so prone not to want order. We're so prone to want our own way, which causes division. So it does take time to get all heads together. Kind of bang them a while and bounce around and cause the sails up there to bounce around every now and then, hit a familiar grouping, you know, and respond with logical thought, which is very seldom with us human beings. Because we're affected by this wrong world and we're affected by our own desires and vanities and pride and desire to be recognized. On and on you go on for almost eternity and why we have problems. And we have to look to the great God who can solve all the problems, which he'll do. For those who are willing to be solved. I've often said we're all problems and only God can solve us. And he's going to make sure all the problems relate to him, and as we relate to him and over time and we all become like God, he solves all the problems. Now, a lot of people think God's going to, you know, somehow bend and become like human beings. He would be a divided individual indeed if he conformed to us. What he's going to do is just say, I'm right, and all of you are going to conform to me. And those of you who conform to me will share life with me forever, and if you don't, I'll burn you up. That's a good way. I mean, that's a good way to get rid of division. Give everyone a chance to be unified, to be at one with the Father and with Christ in the family, in doing your job and in living life. And those who prove they won't be, instead of letting them just stew in their own juice, so to speak, or, you know, venom, God will just burn them up. And they'll be ashes under the feet of the righteous who inherit the earth forever. That's back in Malachi 4. You've read about that. That's why Christ said, you'd better fear him. Don't just fear those who can destroy the body, but you better fear him that can destroy both body and soul in Gehenna fire, because there's no revival from that. There's no coming back from that. That's the second death from which there is no resurrection. He's going to straighten it all out, but there are problems in the process, because and that's why it's difficult to overcome. We have to overcome all these things that keep us divided from God. And so we have to look at the one who is the problem solver, and who will lead us out of all these differences, all of these inconsistencies, incongruities, to become one group. And then when we're that way, he's going to teach the rest of the world through us how to become one. But getting back on the State Department side, the State Department then will control all nations. And the way they rule is going to be done down through Moses. Moses will be the one that administers all rule in the government of God. And he'll work down through David, who will be king over Israel. And then David will work down through the 12 apostles, who will be kings over the 12 tribes. Then others who qualified to be over cities will work under them. And then Moses will work down through or extend that rule down through Daniel as far as the Gentiles are concerned. So through David on the one hand, he's dealing with the Israelites. And through Daniel on the other hand, he's dealing with the Gentiles to make sure they're coordinated into one commonwealth and they all serve under one government and respond to it. And then Daniel will work down through the Apostle Paul. He was an expert in coordinating Gentile groups into groups that were supervised by the apostles. And he turned all the churches in Judea, and that is all the Gentile churches, to follow the churches of God in Judea. That was his whole purpose. Now, since the 12 apostles are going to be elevated from dealing with church groups to dealing with whole nations, don't you think the Apostle Paul, who coordinated these groups into the group supervised by the 12 apostles, would also be elevated to deal with whole nations and coordinate those Gentile nations into the commonwealth of Israel until finally they're all a part of the commonwealth of Israel? Then others will work under him as far as ruling over nations once they're appointed, but to work with and under Daniel and with the Apostle Paul. Then others rule down to the cities. God doesn't identify all of them, because he only identifies enough to reveal the structure so we can, in this end time, understand where we're going to be. That will have to do with ruling all the nations down to the city level. And then working in concert with him will be Joseph, who will be in charge of the world economy to come. You know why his name was Joseph? It means prosperity. Could you tell me why Moses' name was Moses? Why didn't God call one, you know, the name just old Joe. And he sent Joe to deliver the children of Israel. It wouldn't have been a significant name. Moses means drawn out. What a good name. What a revealing name. God drew him out of the Israelites, drew him out of the Nile River, trained him in Egypt, drew him out of Egypt, humbled him for 40 years in the desert, and then drew him out of the desert to draw the Israelites out of Egypt into Palestine. You think that's a rather significant name? Drawn out? Oh, we go into a lot of names. You know why God named Methuselah Methuselah? You know why he lived longer than anyone else who's ever lived? His name meant when he dies, it will be sent, or the flood will be sent. And God had a certain date when he's going to send the flood. He had all that programmed before he put Adam on the face of the earth. He knew that he was going to call a man of Moses' caliber. You know what Noah's caliber. You know what Noah means? It means rest and comfort. And indeed, he fulfilled the meaning of the name. He drowned all the troublemakers, brought Noah through the flood, and there was rest and comfort beside the flood. And he purposed that Noah would be born and raised up and then preach a warning message for 120 years. And then God would send the flood. And no one would ever have believed that a man would preach that long before God would take action. So as Noah continued to preach, can you imagine after 60, 70 years, some of the hecklers must have been saying, well, Noah, we've been hearing this for years ourselves, and our dad and granddad and great-granddad heard you. Now, if God were going to send the flood, he would already have sent it. And every year that heckling got more vocal, and probably after about 115 years, you know, Noah had always said, now, God will send the flood when Methuselah dies. So on the one hand, they say, surely God would have sent the flood already if he intended to send the flood. But on the other hand, how come this fellow's living so long? So Noah always had this example when people said, if God were going to send the flood, he would already have sent it. What if you'd lived in that day, and you were a young person, and you were hearing about Noah preaching that God was going to destroy the world with a flood? That's why he was building the ark, to escape. And you said, well, my dad heard him, and my granddad heard him, and they're still around, and my great-granddad heard him, and my great-great-great-great-great-granddad heard him. Now, surely, if God were really behind him and God were going to send the flood, he would already have sent it. So they kept using that as an excuse, but Noah kept holding up this witness saying, when he dies, it will be sent. So Methuselah died just before the flood was sent. Can you imagine the question, must have circled the earth? He's dead. Oh, he is. Do you see any clouds? So there was a hush all over the world. And sure enough, the clouds began to form. And the rains began to come. That is, after God had gotten, by way of Noah, the ones into the ark that would not argue with him. He said, leave the attorney generals, judges, and receivers outside. But he didn't say, now bring judges in 2 by 2, receivers in 3 by 3, and attorney generals in 1 by 1. He said, leave them outside and bring those in who will cooperate. Bring the hippopotami and the rhinoceri and the mosquito eye. So they won't give you any trouble, Noah. You bring these others in, they're going to harass you from now on. And the boat might not hold up. So here God then began to gather everything in the ark, and sure enough, the rains came, and by the time all these people died, they knew Noah was God's servant. And when they're all resurrected, they're all knowing common. Methuselah indeed was a witness that when he died, the flood would be sent, and then God did send the flood as Noah had predicted. And when all those people come up, they're all going to understand in common that yes, indeed, Noah was God's servant. That is, after they clear their throat, see if there's any water there. It's just after they make sure they can breathe. God is building something far more important than Noah's ark today, I'll guarantee you, and everyone's going to come to understand Mr. Armstrong's position. A lot more so than those who come up are going to know without any shadow of a doubt that Noah was God's servant who predicted and forecasted the flood which did come. God's going to make the whole world come out and bow down before Mr. Armstrong and those who serve willingly under him. God will let no one bypass his apostle, because otherwise God would not respect his own government. God would not back it up if God let people disrespect it and he did not check that and make them respect it. There's not one person, including Ted Armstrong, anyone else, who will ever make the government of God unless they respect the office that God has placed Mr. Herbert Armstrong in. And I'll get into that a little bit later. I mean, if you understand God's plan, you'll understand that God is loyal to his own government and will always back it up and will never allow disrespect to go unchecked. He may let it go unchecked for a while, but there's coming a time when he will make sure that people are forced to respect what he is doing. I have quoted the scripture many a time. Galatians 6, I believe it is, where it says, "Be not deceived, God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, he is going to reap. If anyone sows liberalism, he reaps what liberals are going to get. If anyone sows dissension, he's going to get what God beats out on those who sow discord or dissension. Anyone who rebels is going to reap the consequences of rebellion. But if you sow loyalty and obedience, you reap the benefits of loyalty and obedience. You may have to wait a long time, but you'll always get the fruits of your labors, because God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man sows, he's going to reap." And I see that continually recur in God's Word. As I know individuals that sow discord, disloyalty, and eventually they leave. And eventually get all mixed up. And they reap what they were sowing. They reap the fruits of one who sows discord and unsettles people. Then they become unsettled and confused themselves. Because God always backs up his government. Always, without exception. And you can't find any place in the Bible where God did not back up his government. And he backed them up. Whoever was filling an office, he backed them up whether it was right or wrong. You know what that does? It says, "You're not the judges as to whether my servant is qualified or not qualified. That's my decision. So you just keep out of the judging. And once you establish whom I'm working through, that's my responsibility, not yours." Otherwise, every one of us has to have a worldwide detective agency researching for us, trying to find out all the facts. Then when we got what we thought were the facts, we still could not be absolutely sure as we based a decision on them. Because you can't be sure of what are called facts. You know why? Because you can't read hearts and minds. And you will never know the heart and the mind of the individual who stated whatever you are considering a fact. And since only God can read hearts and minds, God says, "That's my territory, that's my responsibility, therefore don't you judge my servant, because you can't read his heart and his mind." So you begin to assume, in this way or that way, that the intent and purpose of that statement or that action was from this or that or the other type heart. God never allows that. That's why God never, you can't find any area where God let an issue be discussed in his presence. Do you know that? God never let anyone's issue drag God down on the issue. He always backed up authority, every time, without exception. We'll get into that a little bit further later. You need to understand that principle, because that's the area in which Satan trips up more people, when he makes them think they're the judges of how God runs his operation. And if God let people decide whether or not he can or cannot use the servant, God is lowering himself down to the human plane and is therefore wallowing around in the morass and the garbage of human activity, which God will never do. Now on this, I was getting into a few names there. We'll get into, I'll carry through on this a little bit. In that State Department side, and side by side working with Moses to develop the economy of the world to come, will be Joseph, whose name meant prosperity. And he was chosen over his brothers and sent down to Egypt. And there God trained him in handling wealth. Then he sent a famine on his brothers, and they were forced to come down to him and get food. And they had to change their attitude toward him and submit to him. Remember? And God gave them Ephraim and Manasseh. And Ephraim and Manasseh were chosen to be over the other brothers and their descendants over them. And even elderly Jacob, because he understood the plan of God, crossed his hands wittingly And he blessed the younger son with the leading role. The leading role of being the colonizing people, the multitudes of people, the commonwealth of people. Jacob had a practical mind, not a so-called religious mind. The confused, you know, mind of sanctification and all of this, that, and the other. So he crossed his hands willingly, but Jacob knew the first thing that must be done in the world of Mars to colonize all nations under one government. I mean, how in the world can you teach all nations under one government if you do not have a way of colonizing those nations under one control? Then he said of Manasseh, even though he was the older brother, he said, Manasseh will be a great nation as well. You know why the work was raised up in Joseph's descendants today? Because God is going to structure by way of education a way to re-educate Joseph's descendants so they could become the leaders. That wasn't done by accident. God did not raise his work up over in Switzerland because the Gadites are not going to be the leaders. He didn't raise his work up in Reuben because the Reubenites are not going to be the leaders. He raised his work up in Joseph's descendants. Because Jacob crossed his hands and blessed those two sons. So Joseph will handle a world economy, handling all agriculture, technology, industry, and commerce, extending the control out through his own descendants first. There God called a man like Abraham who had tremendous talent in handling wealth. I mean, he was a man who really, everywhere you read of Abraham, he was made wealthy. Wherever he went, he became fabulously wealthy because he had a mind. He had tremendous talent to produce wealth. Then he gave him a son by promise named Isaac. Then he gave Isaac a son called Jacob. And he chose Jacob over Esau before the two lads were born, remember? God was in it. He was working it out. And Jacob was given 12 sons. And that wasn't by accident. God had that program before put Adam on the face of the earth. You know that? I mean, everyone ought to know that. It's one of the most simple truths that's put forth in the Bible. Everyone ought to know about the faith chapter in Hebrews 11. And in the faith chapter, you read about Abel, Enoch, Noah, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Abraham. It says, Abraham departed in the Ur of the Chaldees, and he did all this because he looked for a city whose maker and builder is God, which city has foundations. And you read in Hebrews 11 that Christ explained to all those men, Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, about this city to come. Now, if God explained about the city to come before Abel, or to Abel, then the city was designed long before Jacob. And the city dictates organized structure. It has a wall around it. We read in Hebrews 13, verse 14, that here we have no continuing city, but we seek one to come. Now, Christ doesn't have to explain to you and me individually about New Jerusalem because he's written it in the Bible. We have it in Revelation 21, 22. But of men like Abel, Christ couldn't say, Abel turned to Revelation 21, 22. He said, what translation? So he had to explain to them personally. So he went to Abel and he says, Abel, here's the overall plan being worked out here below. Now the end result is a family that relates back to organized structure, to a city that's going to rule the leading nations of that family. Now if you can trust us to bring about the end result, you will never have to doubt whether or not we can take the step we purpose through you. That's why those men had great vision, because they saw the overall end result. They had confidence God could bring it about, and they didn't doubt then that God could take the step that's necessary toward the end result. If you're absolutely convinced of an end result, then you know God will take all the steps to bring it about. If you're not convinced of the end result, you might doubt whether or not God can take this step at the present time toward that end result. But if you're absolutely sold on the end result, you'll have no doubt whatsoever, and therefore you'll have faith. And faith is the evidence of those things not seen. Not literally seen, but blind the mind's eye, and what God explains, you realize there's going to be an end result, a new earth, in which righteousness dwells. That's what Peter spoke of. You also read about this new city, the city of God on this earth, after it's made new, and that's the city that dictates organized structure. Now, since Christ explained that to Abel, Enoch, Noah, and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and others right on down the line, then it had to be built before Abel. And the city dictates organized structure. It's a city made out of pure gold. That's a basic building block. It's got every type of metallic or building substance that you could imagine. And a lot of them you couldn't imagine. But gold is the basic building block. might say, how in the world could God keep gold together and build a city 1,500 miles high? Well, he's going to come down here and learn from MIT. And that city has a wall around it made out of pure jasper. That's a lot better than picket or rock or barbed wire. It's 211 feet high, approximately, made out of pure jasper, 1,500 miles on every side. And on each side, there are three gates, each one made out of a mammoth pearl. And over each one of those gates is one of the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. And under each one of those gates is one of the names of the 12 apostles. Now, since the city was built before Abel and had 12 gates in the wall around it, then did Jacob produce the wall, or did the wall dictate how many sons Jacob would have and how many apostles Christ would call and choose to be kings over the 12 tribes of Israel? Would all be self-evident? So this wasn't by accident. It wasn't that somehow Abraham just wasn't qualified to have 12 and Isaac, and he gave them to Jacob. He was building an executive team with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham is the one to whom all the promises were made. Then Isaac came along, had to accept the promises and all of the controls that were passed down from Christ to his father Abraham to prove he would submit to his father, because everything came through his father Abraham. Then Jacob was born. He had to submit to Isaac and Abraham what Christ had passed down through them to make sure the three would work together, because they all obeyed the same Christ and look forward to the future according to the same promises. And then once Christ had established that executive team, then he gave Jacob the 12 sons to produce the 12 nations, with which Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and through the structure to be built for them, began the work of the world of mind. They're going to deal, first of all, their own descendants. Don't you think that'd be a little easier to deal with those who are more like you than strangers? So the 12 sons were given to Jacob. What if he ends up, you know, God only got 9 sons and 3 daughters? Wouldn't have worked. What if he got 12 sons the way they would be in this day and age? Still wouldn't have worked. Because you'd have about 3 or 4 going around saying, I'll slap you on the wrist, you don't watch out there. So you'd have some fruitcakes in the bunch. And even if all of them were men and grew up to be men, maybe 1 or 2 would not marry and would not propagate families. But all 12 grew up and married. All 12 produced tribes or nations, which nations are on this earth today, with which Christ, through his government, began the program tomorrow. If you analyze all that, that's quite miraculous. To make sure a man had 12 sons, all of whom married, all of whom had families, all of whose families continued to grow into nations and remained alive for over 3,000 years, that is, their descendants. So they would be here on the earth when Christ intervened, so he could establish control through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob out through their own descendants first. Now, he couldn't get all 12 together, you know, except he has a way of bringing them together. So he selected one son from the 12 to be the leader. And he gave Jacob, you know, Joseph the dreams when he's growing up, remember? And he had a dream. He dreamed a dream. And in that dream, 11 shocks bow down before him. And his mom and dad bowed down before him. And he told the dream to his brothers. And his brothers hated him for it, because he was rid of the father's pet as he looked at it. Because actually what Joseph had were more the talents of his father Jacob than anyone else. In other words, Jacob saw more of himself reflected out through Joseph. And he had a special affinity toward Joseph. And he gave him this many-colored coat, remember, and the brothers hated him for it because they said he's the father's pet. So he was selected out to be the one before whom the other 11 brothers and their descendants would bow down. But they didn't like that. So God had to make sure they'd come to where they did like it. So he let the brothers sell him into Egypt, remember? First of all, they wanted to kill him. Then Judah said, well, let's sell him into Egypt and get some money out of it. So they sold him to a caravan, remember, going to Egypt. And then they killed an animal, a lion or whatever it was, and they put the blood on Joseph's clothing and took it back and broke the heart of their father Jacob. Show how underhanded they are, just like some people I know today that speak against Mr. Armstrong. Take what they've received from him and turn it around to break his heart with it, you see. And having no concern about an elderly man, like the brothers, the sons had no concern about their father Jacob, they wanted to fulfill their stupid, selfish, greedy will. So God knew how to deal with him, so he raised Joseph up to become the prime minister, to be the chief one in Egypt, because he said, only in the throne was the Pharaoh above him. But he said, I was like a father to the Pharaoh. He told the Pharaoh how to run things. And he was made food administrator, along with other things. And he was profound in his ability to handle wealth. I mean, there's no one on the face of the earth today that even began to measure up to Joseph. No economist on the earth today could even begin to measure up. I mean, they couldn't even begin to measure up. Here was a fellow that when he explained to the Pharaoh what the dream meant, you know, and the Pharaoh had the dream about seven fat cows being eaten up by seven lean and all that. And then he said, here's the interpretation of the dream. You're going to have 7 years of plenty and then 7 years of drought. And the Pharaoh said, what should we do? He said, you ought to appoint a man that is sage, wise, capable, these broad abilities. And the Pharaoh said, I don't have anyone in Egypt like that. You've got to be the one, because you're the only one that has the spirit of the living God in you. You're the only one that has this kind of wisdom and knowledge and understanding. He said, well, God made sure that the Pharaoh had to choose Joseph. I mean, that was God's whole purpose and plan. So then Joseph drew up a plan to collect about 20% of the food grown for 7 years. Each year he had to appoint people throughout the whole of Egypt to gather the food. Then he had to build tremendous granaries and storage facilities. And he had to know how to dry food and protect against rot and this, that, and the other, because some of that food had to last for 14 years. So he collected enough in 7 years to keep the human race alive during the next seven. So God was training him in how to handle prosperity for the sake of the people involved. Not in a greedy, selfish, underhanded manner, but in a way that's good for the human race. Then he distributed this wealth over the period of the next 7 years. Now you know the story. During that time, God had sent a famine on Canaan. And the brothers and Jacob and the family, of course, were running out of food. So he says, I hear there's food down in Egypt, sons. I want you to go down there and see if you can acquire some for us. You know who they had to come before? Joseph, just like the dream said. And that's come down, bow down before. You know their attitude was much different. When Joseph got through, when God got through them, boy, they were real humble. They were really fearful of what Joseph might do. And they were just saying, yes, sir, what would you have us do, Joseph? Yes, sir, Brother Joseph. Yes, sir, Prime Minister. Yes, sir, Pharaoh's chief aide. So during the process of all that, God made sure Joseph had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And after, you know, Jacob got down to Egypt and the brothers got down there, and they saw what God had done through Joseph and had this great respect. And Joseph explained why God, allowed them to sell him into Egypt and all that. Then Jacob in his old age was able to put the pieces together more perfectly toward the world tomorrow. He knew that God had chosen his grandfather Abraham and his father Isaac and himself to be the three fathers, to be the executive team. No one else in the Bible fits into the category of fathers. Just three people, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. No one else throughout the Bible is defined as being one of the fathers. So once God had established that, and Jacob saw it, he saw that God had trained Joseph to be the one through whom the blessings. Remember, Christ explained to Abraham that I'm going to bless all nations through you. So he had to establish a way to do that. So Isaac and Jacob had tremendous talents in handling wealth. Remember when Jacob's over to Laban's home? Everything Laban tried to do to thwart wealth, Jacob was able to turn around and make it work for him. And even finally, old unbelieving Laban had to say, I know that God has blessed me because of you, Jacob. And so here God had these three individuals that had tremendous talent for wealth. And everywhere you read about them in the Old Testament, they became wealthy wherever they went. They just had a genius at handling wealth. And God purposed them to bless the whole world with wealth through men that had the capacity. Isn't that much better than trying to bless the world through people who don't know anything about blessings or how to make things work to produce blessings? I think the world's finally going to realize and appreciate the way God has worked it out, because the world will have a lot more because God has individuals training for this coming government that can guarantee greater blessings to the whole human race and later to the whole family of God when it's complete. So by the time he got down to Jacob there and he saw why Joseph was trained, why he was given two sons, and he analyzed these two sons and realized that the younger son had the talents to be the leading peoples in the world tomorrow. He had the colonizing talent, the talent to be a commonwealth of people. And
And Jacob realized that the first thing that had to be done in the world of Mars is to colonize all nations under one government. The first job is to colonize. You can't teach unless you get everyone under the arm that teaches or the government that teaches. So he saw that God had given the younger son the talents for the greater role and the next son the talents for the supporting role. So Jacob crossed his hands wittingly, as you read, and blessed Ephraim with the responsibility of becoming the commonwealth or the multitudes of people and blessing Manasseh to become a great nation. So that Joseph's descendants will be the ones through whom Abraham, Isaac, and that is Christ through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, begin the program of blessing all nations. They have to colonize them first, and Ephraim will be the example in that. In the world tomorrow, when the world sees Canadians and British and Australians and South Africans all under one government, and that government is leading them for the good of all concerned, and they understand some of their differences and their divisions and so forth to pass. And I say, boy, anyone that submits this government is going to be treated in the same way. They're all going to be blessed. This government doesn't single out one and put down the other one. It blesses all who turn to it. And then as they get that example, all the Israelites will begin to follow suit. And then as they do, they will see that Manasseh comes along and shows them how to take these programs and that are delivered by the government of God down through Ephraim and make them work to great national purpose. It's going to be quite a team. Ephraim colonizes and Manasseh comes along to show those programs can be blown up on a grand national scale. Then as other nations come into that commonwealth and follow the example given by the government of God down through Manasseh, which is the United States basically, but it is the United States, but I mean most people here, I'd say at least the majority of them, are Manassehites. And we have the talents, the abilities to do big jobs. We just don't know how to be diplomatic like the British and be a colonizing people. I used to explain on my tour, you know, the difference in the overall image of Ephraimites and Manassehites. We're just not the dignified that people look to by the world as being those that they would trust in, not to be overly emotional or to react in an explosive manner, or to be uncouth in our approach, which we would be. And so as the government of God starts working in the world tomorrow, the executive team will work down through the State Department and begin to colonize the nations in the land of Palestine by way of Ephraim. And then as they're looking to that leadership, then Manasseh will come along and begin to show nations how to become great. Then when all the Israelites fall in line with that, then the Gentiles will, for the first time in the history of the world, look up and say, boy, we'd like to follow the God of Israel. He's such a great God with such great laws. Look at all these people that were Americans divided over there, Canadians divided, British divided, Western Europeans like the Swiss, the French, the Belgians, the Dutch, the Danes, the Norwegians, the Swedes, the Finns, the South Africans, the Australians, all these divided people now in Palestine, all under one government. And they're all responsive to it, and they're all working together. And in addition, they're all worshiping the same God and living lives in the same way. No crime, no corruption, no broken homes, no this, no that, no nothing else, just obeying and following God's overall control, following His government and following His way of life. And that will become a light to the Gentiles, by which the Gentile nations, starting with the former enemies of Germany and Egypt, both Israel and the Jews, will begin to respond and become followers of the God of Israel. That's when God says Assyria and Israel and Egypt are three. They're together, finally. And by way of that example, when they see these former enemies turn to follow the God of Israel, then other nations will begin to turn. Until finally, they're all colonized under one government to become one group of nations worldwide. And once they're there, then that government will show these nations how to participate together for the good of all concerned. As soon as Ted left, I began to preach sermons throughout the Southeast on God's government. And I'm telling that God's government, see and obey it. Don't follow human reasoning and your emotions or you're already gone. And most people follow human reasoning and emotions, just like Adam and Eve. And Satan caught them up that quickly after the great God had taught them. So government is the most important thing that you could possibly learn. And Satan has a barrage of slanderous remarks against God's government. And he's got to keep throwing them out. But as he does, those who hang on will be made stronger. And those who are siphoned off will learn their lesson later. And everyone's going to learn that God never has and never will condone or sanction rebellion. Now, it all goes back to why you and I are here in the first place.
You see, God, way back, there were just two beings, as far as God's ever revealed in the whole universe, or that is, in eternity. Just the two. And those two, somewhere down into eternity, conceived the idea, maybe both of them, maybe one of them. Life is so abundant, and we enjoy life so much, wouldn't it be good to share it with others, but there weren't any others around. And God didn't have a Sears and Roebuck catalog to order them out of. So they had to think, how can we create life? Before that time, they hadn't thought through that because they'd never created life before that. There was a time when God created life for the first time. He'd always been. He was the created being. The two we know as the Father and Christ have always been. All other life has been brought into being by them, but there was a beginning when they first created others. So they brought out the angelic plan of creating angelic beings. And in the process of creating somewhere around 300 million, as far as we can determine, and also creating a universe, as Mr. Armstrong explained, to have them come in and finish it under God's overall supervision. God had quite a structure developed. He had a couple of cherubs that covered his throne, whose wings spread over the very throne of God. He had, the one we know as Jesus Christ in the office suite to the right of him. And he had four living beings and 24 elders. Probably had the universe divided in 24 different sections. And each one had a responsibility over 1/24 of the universe. Then four over them who supervised in a greater way. And each one of them took three of those under them to have higher counsel and higher responsibility. And working right back with Christ and the Father, as we know them today. Then God had archangels and angels. And they were under his supervision doing his work. Now, in the course of that work getting so far removed from God's headquarters, and that's a long way away, that's all behind the whole creation, because Christ ascended to the heavens, remember, when he ascended to his Father's throne. You read in Hebrews 4 when you get the original translation, Hebrews 4:14, I believe it said that Christ ascended through the heavens. Plural. There are three heavens. This heaven in which I've flown many a time, I used to kind of, jokingly state that in a Protestant manner, come to maybe the people in South Africa, I've just been to heaven, brethren. And God has revealed things to me. So I've just got off a 747, which flies up in the first heaven, where the birds fly. A lot of birds have gone to heaven. You don't hear preachers saying that, on a regular basis, do you? And the second heaven is the celestial heaven, in which the heavenly bodies are. And the third heaven is the throne of God. The third heaven is God's throne. Now, Christ ascended through the heavens, this heaven and the universal heaven, to the very throne of God. In other words, God's throne is behind the whole creation. It extends out from him. And the farther out it gets, the bigger. It's kind of like a pyramid in shape. And God was always behind his creation, always supervising out in front of him. Well, he just didn't like to have to turn his head all around, get neck trouble. So he created it out in front of him. And it got into such vast distances that finally God in his expansion program felt it'd be better in expanding to transfer a third of his angels near the job. Isn't that logical? When Mr. Armstrong sent me to London, England, he says, why don't you live over there rather than commute back to L.A. every night? That was a very good decision. Don't you think so? So a third of the angels then were sent out, and this earth was given them as their home base, their first estate. And God took one of his two cherubs that cover his throne, who had seen God in action for no telling how many millions or billions of years. Seeing God in action, therefore, the most qualified of all created beings to come down here and supervise a third of God's angels as near like God as any other being to do it. Everything was signed up then. God would probably have transferred another third to another area of the universe, with another top executive within, and finally another third, and kept expanding, except a problem developed in this first big step. And when Lucifer got down here, supervising these angels, he began to look more and more at what he was doing. He began to focus his attention on what was under him. And he began to lose sight of God of the past. Well, I see that. That happens in God's church very repeatedly. It's the human race has forgotten God so much, they think they came for lovesick amoeba. That's just 6,000 years ago. So people do forget, where they came from and who made them And the fact that he did not make them wouldn't be here, and they try to substitute it by saying, well, we came from lovesick amoeba, or brown soup, or cracks in rocks, or, whatever. Because they don't want to acknowledge a creator that has authority over them. So this being began to look at what he was doing. That was blown up out of proportion progressively. He began to trust in what he was doing more and more, and he lost sight of his creator. He didn't keep in mind that he wouldn't be except for the creator. He would know nothing, have no talents, have no position except for the creator. But people forget that. I've seen that many times in God's church. Mr. Armstrong is used to teach, ordain, and people forget that and get the big head like they don't need him, and they try to do their own work. Same principle, only on a grander scale back then. So this being began to trust in his own abilities more and more and lost sight of God, he began to rise in his own estimation, and God began to lower. Eventually became competitive with his own creator. But he felt he was as good, or maybe in some cases a little better than his creator, because he was more modern. He could understand the modern generations, the angels, and the old man was out of date. He's living in the past. He's senile up there in heaven. So this competitive attitude began to develop, and in order to prove then his superiority, or at least that he was equal with God, he began to introduce inconsistencies. I mean, if you just carry out what someone else says, you don't prove how great you are, you see, but you're just extending his way. So he had to depart from God's way of doing things to begin to prove his greatness. Now, of course, God began to see this and wonder what in the world happened. He'd never seen anything like that before in eternity, in eternity. Because everything he'd ever created before that had always just responded. And he always thought, well, they always will, because I'm the great God, they're my created subjects, like any of you mothers. You have that little 2, 3, or 4-day-old baby there? There's no way in your mind, you know, you have history that shows this has happened a lot of times, but there's no way you look down at your own little baby and think anything except good thoughts. You don't think that baby's going to grow up, grow a mustache, and cut my throat. You just can't think that way. You know, Adolf Hitler was a little baby in his mother's arm one time. She said this in Kraut, this is my little son Adolf. Ain't he sweet? If she could have seen he was going to grow up and grow a mustache and grow up to be a paper hanger and then do what he did, she'd flushed him down the tube. But she didn't conceive that. Now here was the great God, supreme, everlasting, with all power. Why would God even begin to think that one of his creation would try to rival him and try to take over? So when these inconsistencies began to come, I'm sure God was quite surprised and had to deal with Lucifer and let him know, that's not the way I want it done. But instead of saying, yes, sir, he continued to do it his own way more and more. Finally, this led to where God had to get up and say, there's no one qualified to be supreme except me. I'm the only one qualified to be supreme. Because I've always been, I have all power. It's my universe. It's my work, all of you belong to me. And that's about when his mind snapped. He says, who do you think he is? That he has a corner on everything. That he's the only one that can be supreme. He's the only one that can be right. And his way is the only way that will work. You see that in human nature, which is the reflection of Satan himself. And so once he rebelled against that and resented what God had said, then he proceeded to prove he was as great as God, or even greater in certain areas. Once he made up his mind along that line, he had the poison of angels under him. He had 1/3 of God's angels under him. So he had to turn those angels against their very creator. And he didn't have a ready-made world or universe like we have. This whole world is geared to the devil, which is full of slander and lying and conniving and all the cheating and everything else. But this is a pure universe. Nothing evil had ever been committed before. So here was a pure universe, pure relationships, until this being began to depart and get this swellhead and vanity. So he had to turn these angels against their creator and gain their support so that they could support him in his attempt to overthrow God, which he didn't think was an attempt, and he thought it was an absolute surety, just like the attorney general and all the distance behind the attorney general thought this is a pushover. We can go in and got Mr. Armstrong over in Tucson, separate him from headquarters and say, boo, put Wayne Cole in. Everyone's going to then begin to say, Romans 13:1, and you just take over. They realized Mr. Armstrong wasn't old and senile and dead. And that we weren't going to play, lie down and play dead like Rover all over. So you see, Lucifer thought if he'd get all these angels under him, afraid of the angels, and surprise God, and catch God off guard as he thought. You know, maybe God's down the concert. Maybe he's doing this. Maybe Lucifer thought if I catch him in this particular position, finally realized God's never out of control. He always is aware of what's going on. Even though he might be gone a little bit, maybe in Tucson, you know, from Pasadena, so to speak. So Lucifer had to get these angels to back him up. So he began to slander God, very subtly at first, just little tidbits of slander first. But see, he had been at God's throne. They'd never been that close. They'd always been out serving, never in that close relationship. Lucifer had been one of the covering cherubs, which covered the very throne of God, where he could, in that particular stance or vantage point, he could see the great God in action. He heard him counsel, saw him make decisions, probably had many activities with him when they were out of their official stance. God doesn't sit on his throne all the time. Some people think God's glued to the throne. He's got some of this high-powered glue. Once you get a drop of that, you're glued. God only is on his throne when he's in official business to run his universe. Why would God be a slave and sit all the time work? Someone say, why would you think you're going to live forever? Why don't you enjoy life? He says, I never thought of that. God does eat and drink. People say, well, why? Well, why do you eat and drink? And if you say for survival, some of you are getting far more than is needed for survival. You don't eat and drink for survival. You hardly ever think of that. When you sit down at the table and say, boy, I'll survive if I get this. You get a little hungry and your taste buds begin to act up and you see that food and you want to eat it because it's good. But God just enjoys eating and drinking because it adds flavor to life. He could go forever without eating, but he's not trying to set those records. Have a big plaque up there and says, I've got the record on not eating. The longest day of atonement in history. So he eats and drinks. He's got taste buds. We've got taste buds because we can relate to him, become his children. If we prove we'll eat the menu that our Father gives us. And we'll not violate that and look out and grab whatever we think looks good in the universe. A garbage disposal unit or whatever, like people do with pigs. But your garbage disposal unit. Westinghouse never thought of one so perfected. But men make you have to plug it in and run it to the garbage. This thing will go out without being plugged in to find the garbage. And then instead of letting God show us how to use his creation, we throw the garbage out. The garbage disposal gets it, and we turn around and eat him. That is really, failing to see how to live life and how to get the best. So God's a being that enjoys eating and drinking. And Christ said to his disciples, when you're in my Father's kingdom, you will sit on 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. As well, you'll sit around my table and eat and drink with me. He also shows the headquarters city, New Jerusalem, as a crystal clear river of pure running water. And on both sides of it are 12 manner of fruits producing different fruits every month. And God is not limited to 12 flavors. You can look down and say, how did Hines get 57? We only got 12. 12 is foundational beginnings, not endings. So there's no end to God's variety. All you got to do is look at the human beings on this earth, the billions upon billions upon billions of us who've been created, and no two faces just alike. That isn't variety. No two fingerprints are just alike. God takes that same talent in the area of food, dress, recreation, entertainment, culture, music, whatever it is, and there's just no way to exhaust God's capacity as he leads his family into more abundant living. So life continues to get better and better and always has that newness to it. If you're going to live forever, you'd better hope it continues to have newness. If you ever came to a place where God says, that's as far as we can go, I've exhausted my talents. There's nothing new from here on. From this day forward, you will be living in old stuff. And who would want to live forever in old stuff? So God will always keep the edge on life by increasing, by way of his broad talents in all areas of life and productivity, through a system of control, so he can share his ability for living and for production and for doing with a whole vast number of children who are going to be ordered to a way of life and ordered to a way of production. So way back here when God, this great outgoing being that loves to share, to just extend blessings, to just pour out blessings. God just loves to bless. He just loves to extend power and authority. But He learns you can extend it, and it's not received and used as you intend. He was just eager to bless these angels and give them more responsibility and extend blessings. But then they turned around, instead of using those blessings as God intended, turned around to fight God with them. Now God knows He's got to be very careful and make sure you use the blessings and the power and the authority as He desires before He's going to give it. He could make all of us fabulously wealthy, but he'd lose most of us.
Because wealth goes to your head right quick. And you always look around and find out, what can I buy with this wealth? Most of us don't have to look around very much. You ever notice that? Most of us are not all that concerned about how we're going to spend all of our money. Most of us look in there and realize after inflation through the night, we don't have any this morning. We go to bed with $2 in the pocket, wake up, and it's 50 cents. They saw inflation.
So God is a being that loves to extend blessings, extend opportunities, but He knows if you extend them and someone, the recipient, does not understand what you want done with it, how you want it utilized, and will carry through and do it that way, your blessing might be turned into a curse for that individual. So many parents, you know, say, well, I just gave him everything he wants. Look what he did. So God, in extending all these blessings and opportunities, saw this leader finally poison the minds of his angels, who were God's angels. They didn't even belong to Satan. They were just Satan's responsibility to supervise him to do God's work. So he began to, you know, make slanderous remarks toward the great Creator and said, now back then, remember God told you this, but I was there and overheard it, and He didn't tell you all the story. There's been a cover-up at headquarters. And the angel, is that right? Well, I don't believe it. He said, that's true, but I lied to you. Do I look like a liar? He said, no, you look like an angel of light. He said, well, just let your eyes reveal the truth to you. And so they said, well, are you sure this is right? That's right. God did not tell you the whole story. Further, He is not properly rewarding us for our part of the work in the universe. He is siphoning off funds to another galaxy. Because He and His legal representative want a big blowout here eventually. They're going to have the French fathers over in the next galaxy, and when they get real old, they're going to have a big blowout and spend all that money. Oh, in essence, that was all said. Maybe not in those terms, but as Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. What is has already been. And the reason God can emphasize with His apostle so much is because He's only getting a small dose of what was thrown at God originally. So this Lucifer began to poison the minds of the angels against God until they were fighting mad because they had believed the slanderer instead of their Creator. And so they finally joined Him in taking the power that God had committed to them, harnessing that up to use it against the Creator. But God surprised them by intercepting them, putting them down. Then He had a rebellion on His hands. He saw that He couldn't deal with their minds. Their minds were already sealed tight against Him. They believed all the garbage. There was no way God could get them to believe Him after that. They believed Satan. So from that time forward, the only way God has been able to deal with these rebellious angels is by sheer force, not by a willing response on their part. The only reason they'll do whatever God tells them is they know better. They know they're going to be embarrassed if they don't. Kind of like a child. You know, you got this long paddle here that says, yes, you will. And the child says, I won't do it. And the parent says, see this? Yes, you will. And the child may go ahead and do it even though he doesn't want to, but he knows he'd better do it or else yes, you will come. Wow! Brand you, you know. So in this sense, God, they know God has the power and they tremble before His power. And they're going to be embarrassed even further if they do not do what God tells them. They don't do it in a right attitude. They do it only because God Almighty is big enough to say you'll do it or else. But He's had to deal with them in that way. And He wants to make sure something like that never happens again because God lost a third of His angels that He loved a billion times more than any of you women ever loved a child. God had deep love for His own creation. And when they rebelled, it hurt God. God lost a third of His angels. And he saw the other two-thirds hurt because he had to stop the whole angelic program, because when one-third rebelled, it stopped the whole overall balance of what God was doing. So he stopped the whole program. Consequently, the other two-thirds, the angel suffered as a result of what one-third did in rebellion. So God analyzed what happened. Why did they do this? So he saw they looked away from me and lost sight of me and began to trust in themselves, plus the fact they lost sight of what their activities or their actions would do to the other two-thirds angels, their neighbors. So God made up his mind and said, I'm going to make sure I never see that again. I don't want to ever witness such a thing again. But God saw the destructiveness of that and the great loss that rebellion brought about. You know, he named Lucifer by two names that are quite revealing. After this rebellion, he gave him two names, Satan the devil. Satan in Greek means adversary, and devil means slanderer. Get the point? Those angels under Lucifer's leadership became God's adversaries through slander. Through the use of slander, they slandered the great God, that is Lucifer in the eyes of the angels, until these angels were caught up through slander to hate their God and to follow and trust in their leader. He is an absolute artist. He's a genius at turning minds against someone by way of slander. He did that to a third of righteous angels who are much superior to human beings. In a universe that had nothing working for him, he had to initiate everything. And he turned a third of God's angels against the great Creator. Now, anyone with an eye to see ought to see what happens to individuals who lose sight of God behind the Sturmstrom. In their eyes, the Sturmstrom becomes a human leader. Then how easy, how simple, how very simple is it for Satan, the great slanderer, to turn mere human beings against a mere leader by way of slander? I mean, to snap it, to push over. That's why it happened so quickly. God, here's a professional that turned a third of God's angels against the great Creator in a pure universe. Now he has a world that's all reflecting his way of lying, conniving, cheating, a disobedience, a world that hates government, a world that despises dignities, a world that's based on the concept of the survival of the fittest. You do him in before he gets a chance to do you in. Living in a world that just feasts on all that, so that's the setting. And so here, we're mere human beings, subject to all our emotions and passions and caught up, tendencies. So it's nothing for Satan to turn, when he has the whole world already on his side, to take people who get turned off toward his government by looking at either Mr. Lader or Mr. Armstrong or some other point. And once they lose sight of who's behind Mr. Armstrong, then Mr. Armstrong in their eyes becomes a mere human being. And Satan can move them around like pawns on a chessboard at will. And he makes them think they're right. Satan called all these angels who became demons up, and they thought they were right in trying to boot the old man out, and they could run things better than this man who's lost sight of time, who was not up to date with the angels and the latest angelic society. He was just too old to relate to the modern-day angels who wanted to go out and do their thing and develop their own music and their own noise, I should have said, and their own styles and perversions. So Satan can make a heyday. That's why when Dr. Martin turned, he turned and went the opposite direction. I came around even there. You know, I think I mentioned this about Dr. Martin when I was here in 74. But Dr. Martin was a very fine teacher when he was oriented to God. When he was subject to God's government, he was a very fine teacher. But once he rejected government, his mind became disoriented. He had a head full of knowledge, but no longer was there direction given to that knowledge, because he was no longer under Christ's government. And I was often thought of a spinning wheel when I thought of Dr. Martin just spurting this knowledge in all directions. You never know which way it's going to come out. Instead of having direction where it all goes out loyal to God, it spurts out in all kinds of directions. I know Dr. Martin well. I counseled with him twice before he came to college. Before I ever came from Visalia Junior College to Ambassador College, I've known Dr. Martin long time and loved him and his wife, Helen. I've known both of them for 26, 27 years. At least Helen, his wife, for 26, and he for about 25, 24. But I don't agree with rebellion. I don't care how close a friend one is. Once they rebel against God, they break what made us friends in the first place. They broke the bond. We're friends because of God's work. Then when someone steps out of it, he's the one that broke the relationship. I'm still in the same relationship. And they're not going to turn around and say, you're evil. You won't come over and have anything to do with it. No, you're wrong because you're the one that broke the relationship. We were made friends in this work. When you leave the work, you're the one that breaks the bond of friendship. And yet they turn around and try to make us look bad. Say, well, you're bad guys over there. All these bad guys are in Pasadena in the Worldwide Church of God. We good guys. They've just got everything right, and we just love you. Oh, we're so good. We love you. Why don't you love us, you bad guys? Why don't you come over and be our friends? And why don't you go ahead and step out like we did? Well, we just can't do it. Must put God first. So I will always do that. So when Dr. Martin left, Dr. Martin became an enemy of the Word. And I wasn't about to support an enemy. So I went around the churches, and of course this was all done along with Ken Westby's group, and they were in concert. Dr. Martin was going to do the publishing, writing and publishing, and Ken Westby and that, those group of henchmen were going to get the people. And then they couldn't get along very long after that, so they separated ways. But Dr. Martin began to go off so quickly. In spite of his normalcy and his rationalization, his sound mindedness before that, and he began to justify rebellion, until finally he justified the devil's rebellion, and he came up with the concept of, well, he didn't come up with others that spawned that before, but he adopted the concept of universal salvation. That means everyone's going to be saved, even the devil, including the devil. I mean, there's no way you cannot be saved. I mean, there's no way you spit at God, shake your fist, I don't want it, you say, you're going to get saved regardless. So I said, in that conduct, I probably said it here in Rochester, I said, that's very convenient, isn't it? All you've got to do is go out and find the devil and just stick right close to him. So when he gets saved, you get saved too. Isn't that convenient? I mean, there's no way to lose. Just go out and try as hard as you can to find the devil. And stick right by him, and every time he does an evil thing, you do it with him. Every time he takes an evil step, you're right with him. I'm right with you, devil. I'm just as evil as you. We're both going to get saved eventually. I'm sure glad you're going to get saved because I'm going to do all the evil and enjoy it with you. But of course, we're going to both be saved, and it's going to be sad. God's going to save us in spite of ourselves. And everyone who has rebelled, whether it's Raymond Cole, whether it's Paul Royer, or Morris McGuire, or Ted Armstrong, who the dissidents finally joining, like Wayne Cole, Dave Antin, who were fighters before, I mean, they couldn't get along. Now they have a common enemy. You've heard, you know, how a common enemy makes strange bedfellows. These fellows all be fighting one another except they have a common enemy, Mr. Rader, and then behind him, Mr. Armstrong. Because Mr. Armstrong won't fire Stan Rader, therefore he becomes just as much an enemy because he keeps the one they can't stand. Stan. And they all get caught up in rebellion, and they take a 180-degree turn, and they begin to believe just the opposite of what they declared they would never. I mean, what they declared they'd always believe. I know Mr. Armstrong told me, we talked on the phone, he said, Gerald, this was just 1 week after Ted had a meeting in Arcadia. He said, Wayne Cole, he said, Ted Armstrong, Ted just had a meeting out here in Arcadia. And he says, Wayne Cole and Dave Antion both spoke in his meeting. And he said, both of those men assured me and promised me when Ted left they would never have anything to do with him. Now Wayne Cole's joined him, and Dave Antion's joined him, and Al Portune is either joining him or right, you know, with him. He's attended church service. Jared Arvidsson, and you know a lot of people like that. Ben Chapman, we know Ben Chapman, the conspiracy goes way back in spite of what they say. They will color themselves, make themselves look angel white. But it seems like the Bible does say Satan comes as an angel of light. And so does his ministers come as ministers of righteousness. You don't expect the guy to Ted and say, well, I want to tell you all you people, I'm a dirty, rotten rebel. And Wayne Cole says, I want to tell you, I'm a hypocrite. I was in this conspiracy for months. No, they come out and say, I knew nothing about it. I was just innocent there. And they just took this, or they got out of the lift, came over here and tried to point me in Mr. Armstrong's place. I didn't know a thing about it. I was just eating breakfast and came up to the office and all this happened. Reminds me of old Aaron. When Moses came snorting down out of the mountain, he came to Aaron, and Aaron realized this brother might tear me limb from limb. He came up with one of the most ridiculous excuses you could boast. You couldn't have conjured up unless you'd been in the same position, terrified. I mean, shaking, and every fiber, including all your brain cells, were shaking. And Moses came up and said, "What did you do there?" And he said, I'm not guilty. All I did is throw all this gold in the fire, and out came this calf. I didn't know what was coming out. It's amazing how people, I mean, when they realize they're going to be dealt with swiftly, they will come up with some of the most absurd, unbelievable excuses. There was Adam and Eve. I mean, they started it all. God says he's going to stop the point of the finger in the world tomorrow. Back in Isaiah, says he's going to stop the point of the finger. As it started with Adam and Eve, continued right on down, and it's still going on. A lot of people get caught up against government, and they point a finger, and they say, "Stand right there, Herbert Armstrong, money, building, this, that, and the other." And God says, "I'm going to stop the point of the finger." It started with Adam and Eve. He says, "Adam, here's your position. Don't you eat of this fruit." He says, "Eve, you're his wife. You support him, and stay away from this forbidden fruit." The devil came on and said, "Don't let him tell you that." He didn't come along and tell them the positive signs. You know, he should have come along. You know, had been working for God, and said, "Boy, God, General, he's given you everything in the whole garden, and just reserved just one tree for you for himself." Man, it looks like he'd saved at least 90% for himself, giving you only 10%. But he is letting you have everything in the garden, and he's just keeping one little old tree back. That's not the way the devil came. He says, "What is God doing keeping this tree from you?" Boy, he is wrong. This something, he's hiding something. It's a cover-up. This is the way he siphons off funds. And caught them up because they saw it negatively. You heard people, you know, come up and say, "Well, that glass is half full." And they say, "That glass is half empty. Gas tank, you know." You come in, they say, "Is your gas tank half empty? Half full?" You say, "It's half empty. You want some fuel." You know, a lot of times it's the way you say it. So then when they rebel, remember, God came to them and says, "Adam, how come you ate of this fruit?" He says, "Wait a minute, God, get off my toes. It's not my fault. You created the woman. Had you not created the woman, I wouldn't have done it. She enticed me." And then he went to the woman and said, "Now, what have you done? Don't get on me. You should have stood guard at the gate. You let the devil in." See, they passed the buck and they pointed the finger. Adam pointed to Eve. Eve pointed to the devil. God turned around and punished all three. So we all have this tendency of pointing a finger to justify ourselves and to put the guilt on someone else. And God's going to stop that nonsense. He hates that. Lucifer started that by placing all the guilt on God and making himself look so good before the angels. And when they balked, they became enemies of the Most High God. And they've wrecked their future. Totally ruined their minds and ruined their future and wrecked it. And God named this leader the adversary who slandered. The slanderer. He's a professional slanderer. He can catch any of you up that quickly by slander. He can make you think up and down, black as white, bitter as sweet. That quickly. He can make you think what you thought yesterday was right is absolutely wrong. You believe something else today. That's why these people do a flip. Reminds me when I go down the freeway, they say the Bokey did a flip. Just that quick. He's behind you. They say Wayne Cole did a flip. Ted Armstrong flipped about as quickly as a Smokey can on the interstate. If you've ever been caught with one, you know they flip quickly. You ever notice that? I mean, they're coming in, all of a sudden they're behind you with the green light. Say, "Hello. Your insurance is going to go up. They may take your driver's license away. That's bad. I've got my job to do. I've got so many tickets to issue. You're one of the guilty ones. Of course, I know there were a lot of cars past you. I couldn't catch them. They were all in the group. They were going 95. You were going 56. But who am I to get out and endanger myself stopping all them? So you're the one that was causing all the trouble. You're out here by yourself going 56. And these others were safe. They were going 95 bumper to bumper. No danger there." Never ceases to amaze me. I've gotten 4 tickets in my life. They've all been when I've never tried to be in a hurry. I was just taking it easy. When I've really been in a hurry looking, I never got caught. That's usually the way it is. When you're out and causing no problems, late at night, no one else in sight, except the Smokey, he's not in sight.
and the lad he's taught you. But it's a pretty unjust old system. No wonder people get caught up. It's not a uniform system where everyone that's guilty gets caught and punished, and everyone knows that. Then you know what to expect. You might go to one state, and I've had patrolmen pass me at 65 in Tennessee, and a woman passed me going 80 and 85. I was going 65. Although Smokey had me, my heart went up. I looked, saw this woman drive by in a I think it's a tornado or a tornado. And I saw this smoke follow her, and I said, "Boy, she's got it." He pulled off the off ramp, and when I went by, I heard the CB say, he's setting his radar up." And I thought, "Why is he setting his radar up? He just failed to pick a woman up going about 85. That was in Tennessee. I come into Virginia Sunday after I had a Bible study in Roanoke. I wasn't in a hurry. I set my automatic cruise on 58. But it's mountainous. I jumped over the top of this mountain at automatic cruise. I mean, you know, it just jumped 64 miles an hour. And it was jumping 6 miles because I went over a hill, steep incline here, and a sharp curve to the right. And your car accelerates fast. Well, he was right there. He got me. Oh, I wish I could ask you, why did you get me coming up the hill? I was going 58. What, Texas? Anyone knows? I don't want to wear my brakes out. You know, they've got to last a while. If I have to brake, get up the top of the hill and put on my brakes, and then accelerate up, I'm burning excess gas, and I'm wearing my brakes out. But he says, I wouldn't get any tickets that way. How would we get our money? Well, it's a pretty unjust system. I'm glad when that justice is done throughout the world. And everyone who's guilty is going to hear a voice behind him or whatever, and the guilty one's going to be punished, and those who are not guilty will be blessed. And people are going to begin to relate that you're blessed for obedience and you're cursed for disobedience. Then everyone's going to want to be obedient because they realize the blessings come only lawfully from God. So God, in seeing this great rebellion, analyzed it and said, I want to make sure nothing like that ever happens again. So he thought out a family plan. He thought out a plan by which he could let us learn the lesson by making us, in spite of us, we didn't have any choice, putting the human race down here and gearing us to Satan the devil, and letting us have the opportunity of trying to make the devil's way work for 6,000 years by choosing various leaders that God himself makes sure are chosen. Maybe not in every case, but in most cases. So he can make sure that all types of governments have been tried by the end of the 6,000 years to try every type of social development or economic program to the end. We've tried everything in the devil's way, and we have finally proved ourselves and eventually learned the lesson that you can't make the devil's rebellion work. They set aside a period of 6,000 years for his future family to learn by experience that you can't make that rebel's way work. Now, during this 6,000-year period, while the human race is learning in all the various attempts you can't make the devil's way work, and we're coming to this time in which all human life would perish except God prevent it,